I'm Heather Mulligan, President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State. I'm also the host of this podcast called Connect, the Business Council Podcast. We aim to bring you the most interesting interviews with business leaders and newsmakers from around the state.
Hello and welcome into another edition of the Connect Podcast. I'm Patrick Bailey, the Communications Director here at the Business Council of New York State, filling in for our president and CEO, Heather Mulligan. And we have a great topic here today that touches every business across New York State, as does most of the human resource laws and policies in this state. And today we're talking about proposed changes to New York State's disability law. And joining us to talk about that is our very own Frank Kerbin, the Director for Center for Human Resources here at the Business Council. Frank, I appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk to us about this.
Glad to do it.
Well, so there's a lot to talk about here. Essentially, the governor and the legislature both do want to see changes to the New York State's disability laws. They want to see changes to how much of the maximum payout gets paid out weekly. And they also want to guarantee job protection and also extend health coverage. So all those things we'll be talking about today. So let's start with where this came from. Both the governor and the legislature are on board with making changes. So I guess my first question to you is, since that's the case, are we likely to see something happen? Before we get into the specifics, are we likely to see something happen?
Sure. As my HR people know and small business owners know, the maximum benefit for New York State short-term disability has been $170 a week, and it's been that number since 1979, I think, for a long time. So there's always been pressure. The advocates, organized labor, other key people in politics in New York State want to increase that benefit amount.
So, I mean, $170, it just seems like a low figure for 2024. Average salary in the state is certainly much higher than $170 a week. Is there, for those that don't know, who have never dealt with disability, is there an offset cost? That's what the state provides. Is there an offset cost?
Well, you know, we think of it as a low number, but you could think of it in a more macro sense. To what degree should an employer be required to replace the income of workers who become ill or injured away from work, right? This isn't workers' compensation. This is you go skiing and break your leg. You indulge in a dangerous lifestyle, perhaps, and you become ill and need time away from work. To what degree should an employer be responsible for replacing that income? Only 5 states in the United States require employers to provide some sort of insurance coverage for off-the-job injury or illness. So while $170 is low, right, and it hasn't changed in a long time, you could just take a step back and think about whether employers should be doing this at all. But anyway, that question's been settled in New York State. So it is what it is. We have a certain responsibility to our workers to provide coverage for off-the-job illnesses or injuries. And I've forgotten your question now because I went off on that tangent.
So they're going to get $170. Somebody on disability gets $170 from the employer's employer. Are they able to collect money elsewhere if they're not working from the federal government?
This is the requirement of New York employers to provide this insurance policy to pay 50% of your income up to $170 max. Now, as also my HR people know, and people who own businesses and do this as part of their job, managing employee leave is some of the most complicated laws we have. We have federal laws, the Family and Medical Leave Act that applies to employers 50 or more. We have New York State short-term disability. We have workers' compensation. We have paid family leave. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act and human rights law that both require accommodation for individuals with disabilities. So it's entirely possible that someone could be disabled in New York State, receiving their $170 and have other protections, right? They could be getting benefits through social services or through other federal aid to individuals, Medicaid, Medicare, those types of things. So every case is so fact specific. But the one obligation we certainly have as employers is to procure an insurance policy that would pay employees for this benefit for off-the-job illnesses or injuries.
So as you mentioned, the current wage is 50% of wages, $170 max. The governor and the legislature both want to increase it. Have they put out specific numbers? Uh, is question number one. And then the follow-up to those are, we're going to have some areas of focus as an advocacy group is, how much are they going to want to increase it? Again, the first question. And then two, the big question, as always, how's it going to be paid for, correct?
Absolutely. And they're talking big numbers and big changes. One of the numbers we have in New York State is the state's average weekly wage. We all became familiar with this with paid family leave because the paid family leave benefit became two-thirds of the maximum benefit of two-thirds of your salary up to two-thirds of the state's average weekly wage. This is the number that's calculated by the Department of Labor every year, posted on their website. You can Google it and find it. For 2024, that number is $1,718 a week. That is annualized at $89,300 a year. I don't know if that's the average weekly wage in Elmira or Horseheads, where I'm from, but it's a big number. Both the legislature and the governor have proposed tying the disability benefit to the state's average weekly wage. They both take a different way to get there. Eventually, all three bodies, the Senate, the Assembly, and the governor, get to a number where the benefit is two-thirds of the employee's average weekly wage to two-thirds of the state's average weekly wage. That means a benefit would rise from $170 a week this year to, and this wouldn't be fully implemented this year, but if we were using this year's numbers, from $170 a week this year to $1,150 maximum benefit. Remember, two-thirds, it would both propose going to two-thirds of the employee's average weekly wage. So it's possible that someone could get a benefit of over $1,100. And when this is fully implemented, both have like five-year implementation proposals. You know, we're talking about an average weekly wage that I'm sure will exceed $2,000 a week. So we're talking a seven or eight-fold increase in the benefit from $170 to some number in excess of $11, $12, $1,300. So who pays for this? So they all have provisions in their proposals on who pays for it. Currently, it's 60 cents a week is the maximum employee contribution, one half of 1% of their pay up to 60 cents a week. That's been the same since 1959, by the way. That hasn't changed. The governor's proposal, it was, they're very complicated, but in general, it's 40% of the cost is paid for by the employee, 50% by the employer. The legislature has a 70-30 split, 70% paid for by the employer, 30% paid for by the employee. But if we have a sevenfold increase in the benefit, we're going to have a sevenfold increase in the cost of this plan. That would result in additional cost to employers for providing this plan, without a doubt, no matter how you cut this up, 70-30, 60-40, employers are going to have a significant monthly increase in the cost of providing this benefit to employees.
Frank, you're on the phone or in offices and lobbying a lot. Would you agree that that there are certain legislators, and I won't name any because I don't know them specifically, but the perception that I get from our job is that there are certain lawmakers that specifically are in districts that are downstate that assume that all businesses are a quote unquote Amazon type, where they all are just flush with cash and they're all just making a lot of money and really not paying their employees a lot of money. So they just put proposals out such as this, thinking that every business can afford that.
Exactly. We deal with this with minimum wage, with other mandates on employers. You know, the larger employers can absorb cost increases like this. But we have 455,000 businesses in New York State, 451,000 have less than 20 employees. So they cannot absorb those types of cost increases. So if we go to an economy where you want Applebee's and Walmart, and I don't want to mean to point out people, but I'm just saying, if you want national chains at every level, instead of mom and pop businesses and small local businesses, that's the trend, because these large national organizations are better equipped to increase these increased costs of doing business in New York State. You know, we haven't even touched on unemployment insurance and the increased cost to employers there. And, you know, so the cost of doing business in New York is getting greater. And clearly, large national organizations, large organizations can absorb those better than small businesses. And that's not the economy we want. We want an economy of mom and pop businesses, small and mid-sized people. We want to be able to find a path to economic security by starting and having their own business.
So if somebody gets disabled on the job, are they And this is going to roll into the second half of this. There's the first half is the money piece. And the second half, which we mentioned off the top, is the piece of a guaranteed job reinstatement and healthcare coverage. So what does the law say if somebody does get disabled? How long does an employer have to, I guess, let's be blunt, have to keep the employee if they're disabled?
And that's a key, you know, factor in for us human resource people and businesses and for everybody really, but job protected leave is special. And there's only a few instances of leave that have specific job protections to them. The Family Medical Leave Act requires that accommodation for 12 weeks. This is for employers of 50 or more, unpaid leave for family medical illnesses. New York State's paid family leave is job protected leave. You can't terminate someone who's using their 12-week allotment of PFL. And most recently, New York State's paid sick leave law, which requires employers to provide 40 hours or 56 hours, depending on your size, of leave is job protected leave. That's special leave, and it comes with protections and burdens on employers, right? New York State short-term disability and New York State workers' compensation, you mentioned on the job, that's for on-the-job injuries or illnesses, do not have reinstatement rights. The obligation on the employer is to procure the insurance policy and to make sure the benefit is paid, essentially, right? For workers' comp, they get medical bills paid, they get income replacement per the law. For New York State short-term disability, you get merely the $170 we were talking about and income replacement. Both the governor and the legislature proposals in the current budget process we're going through have job protection for New York State short-term disability. This is significant because New York State short-term disability can be up to 26 weeks in each 52-week period. This means if you have someone who becomes disabled off the job, you would have to hold that person a job for potentially 6 months, right? So this is a burden that goes way beyond paid family leave and is something we don't have under disability now or workers' comp now. And that's something I run into a lot with employers is I'll get the calls on our hotline. And they'll ask questions. I have someone who's been on workers' comp or has been on disability forever. I've been paying their health insurance premiums for this whole time. How long do I have to do this? Well, technically, you don't. I mean, now there are other considerations we're going to get into about the Americans with Disabilities Act and accommodating individuals with disabilities. But technically, you don't. And it's important to have a policy in your organization that outlines what you intend to do for employees who become disabled in terms of health insurance continuation and job reinstatement. So that is a question I get frequently in this whole leave management universe we live in is, I have someone who's been out a long time, what do I do? We're in a workforce shortage in this state. It's hard to get people to work as it is. We're holding positions open for people who may never be returning. We're paying health insurance premiums for people who may never be returning. And again, health insurance isn't cheap. So we want to sort of craft a policy or a philosophy for what our organization is going to do for those disabled individuals.
And we'll get to that shortly because I think that's important stuff for material for businesses to have in case this comes up, right? This isn't something that you hope, this isn't something you have to deal with ever. Right. Let alone all the time. So we talked about the piece of the money piece, increasing the benefits. We just slightly touched on the guaranteed job reinstatement. So essentially what you're saying is at the business council, if I go skiing next week and I break my leg and my arm and I'm unable to work for 12 weeks, the business council can essentially say, you can't do your job functions and we're just going to have to find somebody else because we can't wait 12 weeks.
Correct. There might be certain situations where an employer it's a key position. It's someone you need to have filled. You know, it's someone who you need a body there, right? You can go ahead and permanently replace you. And in your example, your broken leg and arm, we can permanently replace you. Now, I don't recommend that. I recommend employers work with employees. If you're a long-term employee and you've been valuable to, you know, we want to try to do that. But there are times when the need is so dire that employers have to replace positions that they should, and they should know that they're able to. Now, there's other, as I mentioned, there's a lot of laws in play here. There's the American Disabilities Act and New York Human Rights Law that requires us to provide accommodation for individuals with disability. So let's say Now, luckily for you, or unfortunately for you, your broken leg and arm don't rise to the level of a disability under the ADA, right? You'll recover from that. But if you have one of the, say you have cancer, or you have some underlying health condition that needs you to, makes you going to be out for 12 weeks, you may rise to the level of having a disability under the ADA or human rights law. And I, as an employer, may have to accommodate you. And one of those accommodations will be leave. If you tell me I need 12 weeks and I'll be back 100% ready to return to work after I get my treatments or my surgery or whatever I do for this qualifying disability, then I have an obligation to hold your job for you. So we're not talking about those people. We're not talking about everybody who goes out and has a baby. We're not going to replace everybody disabled for 8 weeks from maternity. We're talking about people who have, you know, conditions that don't fall into those categories, but we need that position filled. So while I say you can replace everybody on disability and workers' comp, don't do it without calling the hotline first and talking to me, right? Because we'll go through all the scenarios, the fact-specific issues at play here, and we'll determine what can be done. But employers need to know that it's on the table. And any change to that the legislature or governor make as part of this legislative change would be significant. It would be a significant change.
And when is that change? So we want to guarantee the job reinstatement, assuming there's got to be some kind of channels that have to be followed. One, right. Are the governor and the legislature on the same page as to how they want to do that and the time frame? And two, what are those specifics?
All the legislation we've seen from in the budget and elsewhere, the governor, the legislature, all merely have the phrase that it's job protected leave, right? So with that comes all the burdens of you know, holding a job open for someone so they could return to a same or similar job in your organization, which again, a large organization, your Walmarts, your Amazons, you know, your Applebee's, they can do that because they have the flexibility and be able to do that. But if you're one of these small organizations with less than 20 employees, keeping a job open for 12 weeks, and remember, DBL can be 26 weeks. Keeping a job open for 26 weeks every 52 weeks could become a real burden. So, and again, I forgot your question as I got off on my rant.
Well, the question is, are the legislature and the governor on the same page as to how they want to work or implement this?
Yeah, they're unanimous in this phrase that it becomes job protected leave. It would be unlawful to retaliate against someone for using this leave, discriminate against people who are using it, and you have to hold the position open. So yes, everyone is consistent in that. Similarly, health insurance. Health insurance continuation could be an issue, right? Because employers frequently pay some of the premiums and employees pay some of the premiums. For PFL, we're experiencing this, right? Someone will go out for paid family leave. They have to continue making their payments for health insurance while we continue to make ours. Oftentimes, we'll find at the end of the 12 weeks, employees don't return to work from PFL. Maybe they didn't pay their premium while they were out, right? Because they weren't making as much money as they were before they went out on PFL. We have employees who become delinquent with their health insurance premiums. Now the employer has been on the hook. What do I do? How do I get this? How do I collect my share of this? I carried their insurance for this 12 weeks. With PFL, that's the law. With DBL, you could have one of these people out 26 weeks with workers' comp and even longer. You know, we want to make sure that we can protect our organization from having to pay these high health insurance premiums if it's not required.
There's extreme examples, but examples that you see down the road could being legal. And one of those we've talked about a couple of times, every 26 weeks. And you want to give mm-hmm. that example as to how it could work?
You know, again, I come from Western New York. When hunting season started, we would frequently have disabilities flare up, right? I have a back injury. I'm going to be out for the next month when we know they're out deer hunting or whatever. When it's 50% of your pay and $170 a week, there's a disincentive to do that. But if I can get 2/3 of my pay up to $11, $12, $1,300 when fully implemented, there's going to be less of a disincentive to do that. I could have a back problem flare up and get a doctor's note to verify that on June 1st and take the summers off, right? June, July, and August. Every summer, every year, right? So, you know, and I hate to sound cynical, you know, that employees could take advantage, but as the listeners out there know, that sometimes that happens, right? The advocates don't ever see employees wanting to take advantage of something like this, but the fact that it's 2/3 of your pay and the fact that the benefit would be significantly higher reduces the incentive to be at work. and, you know, increases the incentive for abuse. Clearly, those who are disabled, who have serious underlying health conditions, who are having children, these aren't the people we're talking about. We're talking about people who have who could be subject to this type of behavior, and it happens. We know it happens. Like I said, it was a fixture of Western New York hunting season that we would see an increase in DBL claims come up about that same time.
So right now, the law is the law. As you said, employers don't have to keep an employee if there's a long-term disability, assuming they fall under the proper category. So
you don't have other protections. Don't have other protections under the ADA or human rights law. Right. Correct.
As soon as they're not protected, they don't have to keep them. But many employees, I think, employers, I think you find do. So I guess the thing for you that you want to stress to the employer is have a plan. And what does that mean? I'm assuming you want to have the plan up front so everybody knows, maybe starting day one when you're hired, listen, here is our plan. And then that way, you don't have to get into an issue where if I do go skiing and I break both arms and I'm on a on an assembly line and I can't do my function, I know that I'm either going to be protected and I'll have a job waiting for me, or I'm just not function and I'm going to have to be replaced.
Yeah, if you don't have a written plan, we call them policies in the HR bureaucracy. If you don't have a written policy, you're subject to past practice, right? If you don't have any past practice, then you're making it up as you go along. And if you make it up as you go along, you can be accused of being arbitrary and discriminatory, right? So that's why we have policies. So you need to think about what's your organization's philosophy regarding this. What if we did have the Pat Bailey who had some serious arm break and, you know, we had to replace him? He can't do his job because of the nature of his job. He can't work with this. What are we willing to do as an organization? So we could write policies and say, you know, we're willing to hold positions open for people on disability or workers' comp who don't have other protections for, let's say, 90 days, right? We don't want to capture maternity people or paid family leave 12 weeks, right? So let's start at, let's say, 90 days. So your organization can be different. You can pick 120, you can pick 30, whatever you want to do. Every organization has different philosophies on this, right? Some have unlimited leave for maternity. Some have, you know, for paternity. That's great. I encourage all those flexibilities and creativity. But I think we need to commit that to writing so that we could say to employees, you know, oh boy, you know, I'm sorry about this, but at the end of 90 days, your health insurance will be, you'll be eligible for COBRA. Our contribution will end and you have to switch to COBRA or some other health insurance alternative. We'll hold your job for 90 days. After that, we can't guarantee reinstatement. I think it's best practice to put into writing so employees know what they're in for should they have an extended period of disability. It's not unreasonable. It's not unlawful. And it protects the company from these phone calls I get where, you know, I've had someone out on disability. They've been out 6 months. They're coming at an end of their time. I don't know if they're coming back. I don't think they're coming back. And I hear, well, we've been working short staff for 6 months and we've been paying their health insurance for 6 months. Well, that's a big hit on a small organization. We don't want that to happen. We wanted to be prepared and plan ahead by having a good policy in place for this.
All right, let's get your crystal ball out. Where does this proposal to expand all these benefits land? Is it part of the budget process? Is it, which is wrapping up as we speak? Mm-hmm. Is it a standalone issue in the legislature, or does the legislature not get to it this year?
I think today to, you know, Wednesday, April 17th, that it appears this might be falling out of the budget. The governor's proposals and the legislature's proposals were significantly different. They all got to the same place eventually after 5 years, but they were different. I can imagine they're having difficulty hammering out the differences. So let's say it falls out of the budget. Since right now they're in crisis budget mode to wrap everything up. I think the advocates for this will push hard to have this done in the remainder of the legislative session that ends in June. They have, the AFL-CIO has made it one of their top priorities. You know, it's a politically powerful group in Albany. So there will be a push to do it in the legislative session. However, I think it's such a huge dramatic change in policy that maybe this is one of those things that it's on the table this year and then next year becomes more of a reality, more like a when, not if scenario. And maybe we buy another year before we get to firm legislation on what this change would be.
No matter when it happens, you're here to answer the questions that come away for our membership. If you are a member of the Business Council, Frank heads an HR hotline where you can literally pick up the phone and ask him any HR question. Very valuable to the company or to our association, to many of our members, specifically those members who either can't afford an HR department or just too small to have one. And if you're not a member, you should join because Frank is literally at your beck and call. Frank, appreciate you doing this. I know there's a lot on your plate and there's a lot going on in the HR world. You have webinars coming up. Just quickly plug the HR webinar series.
Yeah, we have our monthly webinar series where we take on the hottest breaking news. We have one scheduled for tomorrow, the 18th, which I think we're going to postpone. So if you're listening to this today, Wednesday, it was intended to be a webinar on the labor issues that are included in the budget. It doesn't appear as if we'll have firm information for tomorrow. So it'll be next week, the week of the 22nd, most likely. So tune in for that because there's more to talk about paid breaks for expressing breast milk in the workplace and some other major changes. COVID paid sick leave, we'll have some breaking news. So you want to tune in for that. But every month we have an HR webinar on breaking news. Be sure to look for those.
All right, Frank Kerbin, the director, the Center of the, for Human Resources here at the Business Council. Still a mouthful for me to say, but appreciate you taking the time, Frank.
No problem. Glad to do it.